Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and today we're going to provide another update regarding where Congress stands with the defense bills and how the debates are likely going to impact the Air Force and the Space Force. But first, I'd like to dedicate this episode to U.S. Navy Captain Retired Dale Snort Snodgrass. Now, Snort flew west this past Saturday, and for those that don't know Captain Snodgrass, he was a staunch air and space power advocate, and he showcased the F-14, the F-86, the P-51, and many other aircraft around the world on the airshow circuit, inspiring so many to care about air and space power and to join the profession of arms. Now, Snort also amassed an astonishing 7,900 hours in the U.S. Navy. He was the highest time F-14 Tomcat pilot in the world with 4,900 hours, and he also had 1,187 traps or aircraft carrier landings. And not only was Snort a fighter pilot, he was the head of the Office of Legislative Affairs for the House of Representatives. If there was a person in uniform that understood how things worked on the Hill, it was Captain Snort. And Snort was a friend of mine, and he was a friend of the Mitchell Institute, and he would have been a great contributor to this episode. So with that, this one's for you. Now, we've dug into some of the congressional hearings during the last rendezvous, but we left a lot on the table, and things have continued to evolve. So joining us today are the Honorable Matt Donovan.
Hey, Slick. Great to be here.
Hey, sir. Great to see you. And Major General Retired Larry Stutzstream.
Nice to be with you, Slick.
And Mark Gonzo Gunzinger.
Hi, Slick.
Hey, thank you all for being here. So to kick this off, we're going to explore a hearing that the House Armed Services Committee Subcommittee on Tactical Air and Land Forces held on much of the Navy and the Air Force's aircraft modernization portfolio. We're also going to chat about the latest developments in the Senate Armed Service Committee hearings. So first up, the HASC hearing. As you know, the authorizers in the House and the Senate have a number of subcommittees that oversee various aspects of the Department of Defense and its activities. This one focuses on the number of Air Force priorities, especially fighters and trainers, and another subcommittee looks after the bombers. Okay, Congressman Whitman from Virginia hit upon an issue we talk about all the time at Mitchell, balancing near and long-term risk.
I wanted to begin with talking about what we've been through now essentially for the last 6 years, and that is the need for modernization and the balance between generating current readiness and modernization. And what we're seeing is that there are anticipated projections where conflicts brought over by certain flashpoints around the world like Taiwan may be upon us faster than what we had ever imagined. And when I look at the Air Force's proposed divestments, I see that there are 48 F-15s we're going to retire, 47 F-16s, and 8 C-130s. And I have to ask, if you let us know, what's the Air Force going to do to address this bathtub that you're going to find yourselves in with retiring all these assets as you try to take these savings and plow them into future assets? But many times those aren't going to be available for at least 5 years plus out in the future.
As he indicates, this is a tough issue and there are no clear-cut answers. So how do you see the balance the Air Force is trying to strike this year between divestment and procurement?
Well, it's like, you know, previous attempts at aircraft divestments have generally not turned out as expected, either in freeing enough dollars to make a difference or in achieving expected savings. For instance, you don't really gain much in savings to reinvest unless you vertically divest an entire fleet. That's where you're able to save the entirety of the cost by divesting the depot lines, the supply chain, parts inventories, et cetera. However, you can see how that runs pretty quickly into the political headwinds. Otherwise, when you slice horizontally or peanut butter spread the cuts across fleets, you're saving the flying hour costs for the individual aircraft. But in the end, you only end up with a smaller overall inventory without many dollars available for reinvestment. Another example is in the late 2000s, the Air Force planned to reduce their end strength by 10,000 airmen, hoping to use the savings to procure more F-22s. The problem is by the end of the FYDP, the Future Years Defense Program, or 5 years, the personnel costs inflated at a much higher rate than other costs, chewing up the savings, where now you end up with 10,000 fewer airmen, but with no significant funds realized and available for reinvestment.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Matt. And I take a little different point of view on this, not taking down anything what you said, but the balance between divest and invest is not the balance that concerns me. I would call attention to the balance of risk across time, cutting capacity without, you know, one-for-one replacement, and hopefully with improved capability, that means higher risk in the intermediate term. Let me be more specific. Divesting to invest means there's a period of time, say the next decade, where we are less able to respond to an act of aggression. So what would you think is in the heads of China and Russia? How does this willingness to accept the bathtub and air power prowess affect the calculus of choices? I'm talking about decreasing the power that backstops deterrence. How does it impact our ability to deter? A smaller Air Force now means higher risk, and that may mean crisis will come perhaps earlier than later.
You know, Stutz, I have a great example for what you just mentioned. So it's the Air Force's bomber force. Not surprising, I'm going to talk a little bit about bombers. By 2030, the Air Force may have about 109 bombers available for combat missions, actually in combat squadrons ready to respond to a crisis. And, of course, that would be an increase from today's 86 primary mission bombers that are on the ramp, which is, you know, a new all-time low for the Air Force. So that 86 is after retiring 17 B-1s this fiscal year to help free up resources to field eventually new B-21s and so forth. And as General Nahom, who is the Air Force G-8, said about 2 weeks ago, the bomber bathtub that the Air Force has now is going to deepen in the near term as they begin to take some B-52s offline to re-engine them and otherwise, you know, upgrade them. And that shortfall could extend over the next 6 to 7 years until the upgrades are completed. So overall, that increases the bathtub. That further erodes our nation's ability to deter Chinese and Russian aggression. Now, Indo-PACOM commander has said that China could launch an invasion of Taiwan within the next 5 to 6 years. In other words, as he said, sooner rather than later. So if that occurs, the shortfall in long-range strike capacity that we're going to have in that period of time could greatly degrade Indo-PACOM's ability to defeat a Chinese invasion of Taiwan or another act of aggression in the South China Sea or East China Sea. So you got to look at the risk in terms of how that affects our ability to deter and fight.
Well said, Gonzo.
Okay, here's another one for you, and it's a Navy example. For years, they've come up with specific numerical targets for their aircraft inventories, and this allows members of Congress to easily understand and articulate risk when it comes to their aircraft capacity. Just listen to Congresswoman Vicki Hertzler leverage this.
So last year, the Navy briefed the committee that it predicted a strike fighter shortfall of 49 aircraft in fiscal year 2021 and a shortfall of 12 aircraft in fiscal year 2024. Furthermore, the Navy was not forecast to achieve its strike fighter aircraft inventory goal until 2030. But now, for FY 2022 planning, the Navy asserts that the strike fighter inventory shortfall will be resolved to zero in FY 2025, which is 5 years earlier than planned.
So given the Air Force's clear aircraft capacity problems, you'd think the Air Force would harness something just like this. But in reality, they've resisted. Why do you think this is the case? And what are the pros and cons?
Oh, let me jump in, Slick. It's quite the contrast between how the Navy can point to a billboard number and every head in the room nods yes, as if, yes, we all get it. That's the number, uncompromising. It doesn't matter if there's the budget money for it. It just stands as that requirement. The Air Force just hasn't been able to devise similarly visible and unwavering benchmarks, essentially, despite as you recall, the efforts of the analysis of the Air Force we need to find that 386 squadrons as the needed force size today. A few years later, and the Air Force backs away from 386. In fact, a better word might be withered away. Another example, F-35. The requirement is 1,763, but leaders have thrown around publicly, well, maybe it's something less. Maybe it's 1,000 or hey, we won't buy that many because we've got something on a PowerPoint slide out there in the future. And it's confusing to the public. I believe it's confusing to the Hill. Another example, previous chief of staff was adamant about buying a minimum of 72 F-35s a year. Just a few years later, the Air Force is asking for 48. And they're asking Congress, please don't plus us up anymore like you have in the last few years. So I'm curious, Gonzo, you've worked for decades on presentation and force planning. What's your take on this?
Well, first, I bet the Air Force wishes it had a shortfall of only 49 fighters. But let's talk about 386 in terms of risk. The 2018 NDAA directed the Air Force to give the Congress a force planning construct and a 2030 force structure that is needed to implement the National Defense Strategy at a low to moderate level of risk. So the Air Force said it needed to grow to 386 operational squadrons from its current 312 operational squadrons. It's about a 24% growth. And that's not unreasonable given that the Air Force had 401 operational squadrons at the end of the Cold War, the last period of great power competition. Back to risk. That means right now the Air Force lacks the forces needed to fight a single war plus sustain nuclear deterrence and deter other threats to our homeland. But there's another problem here, and that's what you mentioned. Most people don't know what the heck an operational squadron is. Can you answer me right now what an operational bomber squadron is and how many jets are in that squadron? No. Oh, so the Navy explains its force structure needs in terms of a combat fleet size, number of carrier battle groups that its budget can sustain. The Marine Corps uses MEFs and Marine Air Ground Task Forces. The Army has brigade combat teams. The Air Force really needs a way to present its forces that is clear and communicates what its force sizing requirements are, as well as its capacity to support the combatant commanders.
Hey, Gonzo, and also, you agree that generally the public, the Hill, they understand these units of measure that the Marines and Navy uses compared to the squadron entity. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, because the other services have used them for decades. They've explained it, and the Air Force has been all over a map. So, Air Force, do you really have 72 fighters in each of your operational fighter squadrons? Well, no, that's a notional a wing, that is, 72 fighter aircraft is a wing, but we have lots of wings with different numbers in them. We just kind of, Congress gets lost in the details.
Yeah, let me jump in here. I think from the Congress's perspective, I think the Air Force continues to misread how Congress looks at this issue. For them, it's really all about the numbers of widgets or airplanes or, whatever the unit is that translates into jobs or payroll in their states and districts. When the 386 squadron requirement was rolled out, the immediate questions for Congress were, so how many total fighters is that? Or how many total bombers is that?
Exactly.
But we couldn't provide solid answers. The Navy always clearly specifies their total fighter requirement by fiscal year, then highlights the fighter shortfalls by year as a negative number, a shortfall. We have to be very clear about what the requirement is. That's a different issue than what we can afford. For years, the Air Force used the construct of a planning force, that is the requirement, versus the program force, or what we're budgeted for. The space between those two numbers represents the level of warfighting risk that is assumed by the DoD. And during the Budget Control Act, the years of steep funding cuts, I think we got too focused on the what we can afford side of the equation and haven't paid enough attention to the what is the requirement side. We started to when the 2018 National Defense Strategy came out, but I think we have a lot of muscle memory from those Budget Control Act and sequestration years.
So those are great points, Matt. Wouldn't you also agree another factor that confuses the Congress is the Air Force's inability or unwillingness, pick your term, to stick to a number once it does define what that planning force is?
Well, absolutely. I mean, consistency from year to year You know, for example, 15 years ago, Air Force leaders were absolutely adamant that we're not going to buy any new old aircraft. In other words, no F-15s, F-16s, and we're going to go for an all fifth generation fourths. And we've seen over the past few years how that has now evolved. You know, the natural reaction from Congress is, okay, well, what is it you really wanted? Because, you know, when they have hearings, they just go to last year's transcript or 2 years ago, and they go, you know, either you said or your predecessor said this, and now you're saying that. And it's really a problem if we're going to flip-flop on positions over there, because it confuses them.
All right. Well, one final topic highlighted a lot during the HASC hearing was C-130 fleet management. Now, there wasn't a clean quote to pull on this topic, but members highlighted the C-130 a lot. So everything from concern over requested divestitures to prioritizing C-130 upgrades. So why is a C-130 such a major issue in Congress?
Well, let me jump in here first, Slick. You know, the C-130s under discussion are all in the Air National Guard. And the C-130 is almost the ideal dual-use asset. That is dual use for both federal and state mission assignments. It has a federal military role for tactical intra-theater airlift during overseas contingencies or conflicts, but it also has a very well-defined Title 32 state National Guard role for disaster response, humanitarian assistance, evacuations, firefighting, and those similar type of missions. It's probably the one Air Force asset with the strongest argument for governors and their adjutant generals to make, which makes it very difficult for big Air Force to divest without a very strong rationale or a solid plan to backfill an uncovered mission area. It's much harder for governors to use the dual use argument for other Air Force assets, such as fighters or even tankers. So it's always a big hill to climb for the Air Force to divest those aircraft.
Okay, so I'm going to stick with our theme of thinking of this issue in terms of future operational requirements. Now, the Air Force aspires to have the ability to create a force structure in theater during a crisis that is highly distributed. It can't continue to plan to operate from a very small number of main operating bases, given China's and Russia's ability to strike those bases with cruise missiles and ballistic missiles that would really suppress the Air Force's sortie generation capacity. So the Air Force has created operational concepts for doing that, including Agile Combat Employment, ACE, logistics under attack, and so on. So what are the mobility requirements to support a force structure that is operating from a highly distributed posture, especially in the vast expanses of the Indo-Pacific? You have to consider that requirement when you're thinking about C-130 force and C-17 force in the future, especially C-130s that can use short runways and even unimproved landing strips to support that kind of a posture. And that's the kind of question that our Air Force, ROSD, and Congress should be asking.
Well, Gonzo, those are all excellent points. And in the Air Force's defense, the 2018 Mobility Capability Requirements Study results did allow for some divestitures of intra-theater airlift capacity. But I understand the 2020 edition of that study may have produced somewhat different results, and I'm not sure if that's been released yet or not. So this was all in the throes of adjusting to their agile combat employment concepts and that sort of thing. So you know, I think it remains to be seen, but it still goes back to, you know, congressmen and senators from the different states that have these capabilities in their guard units have a much more base interest in it as well.
Yeah, let me add one other perspective. I love the 130. I love the 130 mission. I love that that community. And one good thing about keeping all those 130s coming is it gives us a lot of air power advocacy across the United States, and there we can't have too much of that.
Okay, so over to the SASC. who recently executed their markup. And that's when the committee members actually decide on the specific funding levels, the policy provisions, and a range of other details that comprise the bill. It'll go to the floor later for further debate, amendments, and a vote, but the committee markup is what fundamentally shapes it. First off, I see the committee locked up a bunch of tails that the United States Air Force was trying to divest, and the details are not totally clear. But it seems that there are a limited number of tankers that appear to be allowed to retire. So fighters and bombers were not specifically highlighted, and they also sent a shot across the bow regarding the need to maintain a larger bomber inventory when the B-21 enters the fleet. So what are your thoughts on this?
This is forced divestiture to cede manpower for a replacement system. That makes a lot of sense if you refuse to fight for a higher manpower and strength.
Yeah, Stutz, you hit the target. Now, the SASC supported most of the Air Force's requested tanker requirements, for example, to facilitate the, as I said, I'm quoting here, acceleration of the KC-46 force bed down. The Air Force wanted to retire 18 KC-135s next fiscal year, and SASC would authorize retiring up to 18. The Air Force also wants to retire 14 KC-10s next year, and SASC would authorize 12, retiring 12. So to your point, whenever a service transitions from one major weapon system to another, it simply takes time to train new crews, maintainers, and other personnel that have to support that new weapon system. That's true for the Air Force, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard for that matter. But the Air Force doesn't have a pad of excess end strength to do that, unlike the Army, which calculates what it needs to support their force modernization initiative so it doesn't create excess risk. So the Air Force has to retire the old in order to free up personnel and other resources to spin up the new. And that can create gaps in force capacity, which increase risk.
So from a Congress's perspective, the first rule is all politics are local. So even though a member of Congress may agree in principle with the general rationale for a divestment of aircraft, it becomes a not in my backyard argument. You know, from their point of view, they have local constituencies they have to pay attention to, jobs to maintain, et cetera. That is, if they want to keep their own jobs. So when the Air Force proposed the Combat Air Forces reduction or CAF redux in the fiscal year 2010 budget to retire 250 of our oldest fighters, it was the first time in history where Congress approved to retire 100% of the aircraft that were proposed to be retired in the budget, because there was a base-by-base plan that detailed exactly what the backfill plan involved. So every affected member of Congress could see the impact, get behind the plan, and then be able to explain it to his or her constituents. It just has to get to that level of detail if you want to be successful, because it simply can't be explained away by hand-waving or vague generalities. For example, if the Air Force announced the replacement of the 36 A-10s it wants to divest at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base with F-35s, oh, by the way, the plane that is already slated to replace it, you would get a far different reaction from the Arizona delegation, in my opinion. And it also takes the wind out of the F-35s don't perform the close air support mission as well argument, where on the other side of the state, in Yuma, that's all the Marines are using their F-35Bs right. for, is the close air support mission.
Yeah.
So, secondly, and to your point, Gonzo, you know, as manpower seems to be the long pole in the tent, another approach could be for the Air Force to request a temporary increase in end strength over a limited number of years to get them through a transition period of aircraft replacements.
Here, here.
And that decrease gradually after the aircraft unit transitions are completed.
Yeah, I completely agree with that.
Slick, let me remind you of that one sentence you said about the need to maintain a larger bomber inventory when the B-21s come on board. Gonzo's comments here imply a lot more for the B-21 first. Yes, there is a number of total bombers established, and it's realistic based on threat and where the threat's headed. But good studies show that number may be understated as much as 50%. But here's the insight to what Gonzo was saying earlier. There's a bomber shortage into the 2030s, and that is a huge risk to the nation's interests. And so we get to what's important, and that's the procurement rate of the B-21. That needs to, going back to what we were talking about with Navy numbers, that needs to be the billboard number that airmen state as a requirement. It has to go significantly higher than what's being planned today to close that gap and penetrating capability as rapidly as possible.
Okay, we also see the SASC taking steps on the F-35 Joint Program Office. Can you provide some background and talk to us about this one?
I'll jump in here as I actually worked this when I was on the committee. The Senate version of the fiscal year 2017 NDAA had language that required the JPO to disband and the services to take over the mission within 6 months after a Milestone C full rate production decision, which, by the way, even today has still not yet occurred. During the NDAA conference that year, it got walked back to a study on JPO alternative management structures, which Ellen Lord and her folks completed within the ANS organization. It's really an excellent in-depth report, and I highly encourage folks who are interested in the subject to read it. But in the end, I think the committee's opinion remains that the JPO was designed as a procurement organization, and it's not optimized as a sustainment organization, given all the attention on the operations and sustainment costs of the F-35.
Yeah, one thing I know, Matt, is here at Mitchell, we get a lot of inputs from all the wings of the enterprise of the F-35. And what we know is the JPO has a lot of manpower, and it's creating a lot of frustration as the program matures, and it will be a chore to transition out of the JPO into some other model.
And Stutz, that's exactly right. And you know, the last I heard, there's close to 3,000 people in that joint program office. You know, the genesis behind the FY17 language was, you know, although it was designed to be a joint program with the three variants having a commonality rate of 85 to 90%. In reality, the commonality between the different variants is more like 20%. There are really three different airplanes. And, you know, I, at the time, the thought was, wouldn't it be better managed by the service that has the preponderance of that variant of the airplane? So in other words, right, the A model for the Air Force and the Department of the Navy take the F-35B and C models and then deal with the sustainment issues within the service. You know, you'll always probably still need some sort of JPO to handle the procurement end of it and dealing with the partners and all that sort of thing. But I think we've proved over the years that this is probably not the optimized organization that we have today.
Well, well said. And I would just say that planning needs to begin in earnest at some point, so it may as well start today.
Well, sticking with the F-35, it's obviously a big topic that we like to talk about here at Mitchell. What are you seeing regarding the F-35 coming out of the SAS?
Well, interesting. The Air Force asked for 48 tails and please, Congress, no more plus-ups as in past years. Congress complied. And with all the modernization ahead, it's difficult to see how the Air Force will ever ramp up F-35 procurement. You know, they're looking at GBSD on the horizon, the tanker, the B-21, the T-7. And I'd also note, you know, that the F-35 was not on the unfunded list. They had F-15EXs about the same price and are not stealthy. So it's hard to say where we begin that ramp.
Well, and, you know, let me just jump in here and say that it's really a math problem. So the Air Force's portion of the F-35 buy is 1,763, as you mentioned before. So far, we have about 300 or so delivered that are on the ramp and in the immediate pipeline. So that leaves about 1,400 or so remaining to be procured. And at 48 a year, you're talking somewhere north of 28 years to continue buying these and moving out in that direction to get them done. And the airplane's already a 20-year-old design. We should have been up at about the 110 F-35A models being procured a year at this point in the procurement program. And we've never gotten close to that. So it's a numbers problem. It's a math problem.
Yeah, I like the approach of the Ronald Reagan era. You know, buy them while you can and figure it out later. As you recall, we had F-16s and other aircraft on the ramp without engines. But thankfully, that worked out to give us a lot larger inventory of aircraft down the road.
Well, there is concern about buying airplanes that are not ready to be upgraded to the Block 4 configuration now, which we know is coming. But on the other hand, you're never going to bail on upgrade an airplane that you never bought to begin with. So there's that.
Yeah, I like the Ronald Reagan approach. Two points, though. First, they had actual programs hot and ready to go. The Air Force could buy jets. The second thing, of course, is a lot of those jets are still on the ramp today. That's the force in being. I remember when I was working for the chief, actually General Abdullah for the chief, for QDR 2000. We were in with the chief, and he kind of explained the theory of how the Air Force is going to modernize its forces. First, it was going to finish modernizing its inter-theater airlift force, C-17s, buy them out. And then it was going to do the tankers and the fighters, and after that, it would get to the bombers. Sounds great until the tanker was delayed, the F-22 program was truncated, far shorter requirements. They started a bomber program, next-generation bomber program, and then that was killed, driving up another 6 to 7 years delay in before the B-21 program spun up. And guess what? Now all those capabilities have to be bought at the same time, and there's simply not enough budget to do that, in the Air Force's budget at least.
All right, now switching to space, any operations or vectors coming out of this markup?
I'll jump in on a short piece here. As a fighter pilot, it was an interesting assignment to be director of Air Force Weather for a year. Well out of what I was used to, and I learned a lot. And those two experiences make me thrilled to see the next generation weather satellite is funded. That needs to press ahead if they can accelerate it. It needs to be accelerated. Let me tell you, fifth generation fighters and next generation bombers need environmental intelligence, not Cold War doctrine and technology. So this is a good report coming out of what I see here.
I appreciate that. And Mr. Donovan, how about you?
You know, there's a couple of points I wanted to make about it. First, it's interesting to see how the SASC approached the Space National Guard issue by just renaming the Air National Guard to the Air and Space National Guard. You know, the Senate is very concerned with increasing the overhead costs and bureaucracy that goes along with standing up a new organization, such as the separate Space National Guard. And the second point was, it's also interesting to see that the SASC actually plussed up the DoD budget request by $25 billion. And then they funded just about every service chief unfunded priority list item that was submitted by each service, which makes it even more puzzling to me why the Space Force didn't submit a larger unfunded priority list with bold capabilities in it, even if it were in a classified submission. So there may be some buyer's remorse associated with that on the part of the Chief of Space Operations.
Well, gentlemen, that's all we have time for today. Thank you all so much for being here again, and I look forward to the next rendezvous.
Thanks, Slick, for all your time and your work here. Thanks.
Thanks, Slick. Great to be back.
Hey, Slick. Till next time.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.